Hello again, everyone. Freeman here to give you a little overview of what's about to happen with the last recap of our run of Troubles in Otari. We recorded Chapter 3 well after our initial test recordings of 1 and 2, and it was tough to get back into the swing of things, especially in the midst of our continued recording of Stemming the Tide. And it was around the time that we were still on hiatus for Encounter This and planning our Episode 100 extravaganza for that long-running show. Why we revisited the adventure was for multiple reasons. Firstly, we really wanted to give our good buddy Cam a test run and an effective audition, which I'm very glad to say has panned out very well for all of us in the end. We also wanted to either revisit characters that were introduced in our formative recording days, or just test out new character ideas. Not to mention loose ends to story beats that we've often dropped hints at, but never felt we even knew the full story ourselves since we hadn't properly completed it. In any case, you are about to hear a recap of those events, replete with nods to those story beats and the characters that have newly or continually influenced the content that's coming ahead, with our episode 100 and the lead-up bonus content involved. If you're a Patreon subscriber and are listening on that feed, stick around after the recap for another interview with myself and Cam, discussing their experience in joining us, amongst many other things. Cool waves now lapped calmly along the southern coast of the Isle of Kortos. The summer months now at a close, and the peak of the season at Weinmar's Rotten Boat Club had dwindled. While the area may not have been known for its frigid temperatures, it was still closer to a time when folks more often bundled up by the hearth, sipping warm spiced wine and enjoying a game of cards. And Weinmar's was not devoid of guests, far from it. Some things had changed, and some were comfortably familiar. The sight of a plump old Shuni napping on the porch, for example, was all too familiar. Arthur snored away in his semi-retirement, trademark sausage roll crumbs scattered across his belly and chest. Also among the recurring themes was the lively circus-trained juggling of a mustachioed strongman behind the wood of the bar, tossing bottles filled with expensive spirit each time a guest called for a drink. A better performer in controlled circumstances rather than in the field. And let's not forget the casual, subtle demeanor of the Tengu Jakira, trying to enjoy a quiet beverage after a day of tending the grounds, despite the one-man commotion machine behind the bar. However, as of most recently in this part of the tale, feathers ruffled and the small hairs of the strongman's arm rose each time a particular guest ordered their drink. As the guest did not budge, and insisted the barman stay well separated behind his barrier, and an invisible something would deliver the beverage in a silent and ghostly floating manner. The discomfort this caused was not lost on the guest either. Much to his amusement, in fact, Lord Corvin Rycroft and his raven Elijah delighted in teasing the dim-witted beast of a barkeep and the silent brooding crowman. Lord Corvin was a wizard with an unmissable air of lazy pompousness, as far as lazy goes, for a rather studious student of magic, that is. David Ettercap was noticeably missing, which did not help in the mounting tensions. He always played a good buffer between the staff, the guests, and the ever-energetic scallywing Ollie, whose vanity was difficult to nip in the bud. "Look at me! Look how pretty I am!" he obsessively screamed to any who would listen. But alas, David's next professional step had seen him head back to Absalom to shop Aelin Weinmar's autobiographical memoirs to potential publishing houses. However, even Ollie's chatterboxing could be overshadowed when the right person came along. Telford Rawline was the other guest in residence, and just such a person. He somehow managed to throw Ollie off his usual irritating rhythm with the simple, curious blankness of his character. An esoteric person with an intense interest in the esoteric mysteries scattered across the Isle of Kortos, with his own esoteric powers to match. It would be a disservice to say he didn't also find humor in Corvin's silly tricks. But, as you know, this tale is not about who left what review, remarked what to which staff, or signed the guestbook. I've tried to spare you the mundane so far, and do forgive me if the comfort of my verbal hearth has warmed you into drowsiness. This tale of peace and quiet does indeed pick up again, and it starts with a knocking at the door and the handing out of a letter. The letter read as follows.
"Salutations, Weinmar and friends. It has come to my attention that a rather esoteric mystery remains unsolved despite recent investigations. I fear it may also involve some imminent danger to the surrounding areas as well. While I feel Otari is reasonably safe, the outliers such as you and yours and the farmsteads along the Granary Road may not find themselves so lucky. Secrets and magical items are to be found, and perhaps in this slow season of tourism, you might wish to stretch your adventuring legs once more and see what can be uncovered, for protection of the innocent and potential profits. Please come see me at the Dawnflower Library, Vandy Benderdash, Head Librarian and High Priestess of Sarenrae. What could not have been known to Aelin was that this letter would set him down a path that would answer a question presented by a letter he had found months before, and he could not have anticipated that his very own guests would join him on this deed. With eagerness, in fact. For the mention of magic and the esoteric was all that was needed to pique the interests of the Lord of Rycroft and the psychic Telford. Leaving Miroslav behind to care for the club in Aelin and Jakira's stead, the only thing to worry about was the inventory levels upon return, which was better than the stress of someone's life in the balance and placing said balance in the strongman's hands. And Arfur would keep an eye on him anyhow, unless of course he really did sleep with his eyes open. And off to see Vandy they marched, the cooling autumn breeze hastening their steps towards something different, if not exciting for all. Vandy was very pleased to see so many answer her call and was quick to explain the situation, but not before offering some lemon cookies and a spicy blend of Kadiran tea. The crew being familiar with the recent rise in monster activity in the area, Vandy explained that in response to this rise, a call for Sarenrae's faithful had gone out to the various temples on Kortos. One who answered was Thaida Aubade, champion of the Dawnflower, who had already been looking into a cult to the goddess Lomashtu, the mother of monsters. Along with her squire, a halfling by the name of Billard Truewood, and a dwarven acolyte named Vuzi Naren, Thaida scoured the greater Otari area for evidence of the cult. She reported back regularly to provide a copy of her findings to the library and continued about her search. However, it had been some months since her last visit. Vandy, understanding well the dangers of such a task, felt that Thaida and her companions were likely dead. Her memory of their task was sparked when she had come across the copy of Thaida's ledger. The final entries detailed the capture and punishment of a kobold cultist. In repentance, the kobold detailed the location of a secret lair known to the cultists as the Scar, and warned of the dangerous illusions that protect its entrance, stating, "Only those gifted with three-eyed sight may enter." And by all accounts in the letter, it would appear that Thaida's mission produced a noticeable decrease in the monster population. However, her disappearance and that of her companions months ago may mean the cult had had time to recover. Vandy also noted that the ledger described a valuable item dedicated to the Dawnflower herself and was in the squire's possession. A sunwheel was a powerful item likely gifted to Billard for his own personal protection. But assuming they had fallen to the cult, the sacred item would likely be useless to the Lomashtans, but sacred nonetheless, and Vandy would have seen it returned to rightful hands. With the ledger in hand, exhaustingly dry in its meticulous detail as it was, the crew took up the mission left behind by Thaida and her faithful, and they set out to find this scar. Bushwhacking their way through the wilderness, the crew came upon a low hill within the trees and found themselves confronted by a warband of orcs lost among the forest. Charging with battle cries to Lomashtu, the crew was attacked by the warband and found the ferocity of the orcs to be no small challenge. However, when all but one was eventually struck down, that one orc surrendered when surrounded by his dead kin. Rejected and spurned at every turn, this warband of orcs were alienated from civilization after their role in the Tarbifon siege on Absalom years before. They had caught wind of this cult of the Mother of Monsters and sought the Scar in hopes for a place of acceptance for their kind. Aelin made the decision to let the orc go and seek a home elsewhere on his own. But that didn't stop Corvin from taking a pot shot with his hand crossbow at the orc's back, just for fun. Though it missed, Aelin was unnerved by the callousness of this action, and wondered if Corvin could be trusted moving forward. But the pragmatist within him knew a dangerous weapon often made a good ally. He would soon be proven right, as the crew continued on their path and found an impossible landscape of ruined and scarred terrain. Stepping forward, the illusions attacked their minds until Corvin put his studies to work and dispelled the effect for all. After taking some shelter on the underside of a small cliff to recuperate, the crew found, hidden behind a curtain of moss, an elaborate door with no handle or hinge that could be discerned, but a gridded panel of raised squares poised ready for the correctly pushed combination.
Consulting the final entry of Thida's ledger, the clues to this puzzle were the last pieces of evidence that she had found. This was one of the rare Five Beasts locks known to be used by Lamashtan cults. And with this information and some clever thinking, the crew was able to enter an ancient, what appeared to be half-completed, dungeon, long forgotten since the death of its unknown creator. With a crossroad of hallways ahead, it was Telford's keen eye that then saw him save the lives of the crew, as he spotted the pressure plates of an elaborate trap designed to cover any who entered the intersection ahead in intense alchemical flame. With delicate pacing, the crew moved forward, wary of anything that lurks unseen, and among those that lurked were kobold cultists ready to pounce. The little dragonkin creatures tried hard to protect their home, but just like the orcs, when all but one had fallen, the crew found they were again at the head of mercy for a single surrendering enemy. Claiming to be a member of the clan of Stonefang kobolds that were driven out of Absalom, the villainous thing betrayed its new home with information in order to save its own hide. They squealed about the nasty brutes to the east, dangerous feathered beasts to the north, awful screechers in the Room of Statues, and something about a green lady to the northeast. Most importantly, the kobold spoke of Mweeba, their leader, a jackal gifted with the three-eyed sight by Lamashtu herself. This Mweeba was working towards ushering in the beginning of the Age of Monsters. Despite what little help this information offered, the kobold was set free, this time without a shot to the back, and the crew set forth. They found the feathered beasts to be owlbears, protecting their unhatched young, and as vicious as one might expect. It would be a gross inaccuracy to say they were soundly defeated, as nearly the entire crew was eviscerated by their claws and beaks. But in a strange and bold move, the crew stirred up the screechers, which turned out to be harpies, and managed to see the owlbears fall victim to their song, closing the doors behind them and letting them duke it out, as they say. The nasty brutes the kobold referred to were in fact ogres, bored and eager for blood. In that battle, the crew saw the intense power of Talford's mind unleashed, and they employed the clever tactic of luring the giant kin into the alchemical trap and burning them alive. Aelin thought he was beyond these gruesome moments in his life. He missed David's inspiring presence, but was half glad he was not here to see these brutal events. He could already imagine the overblown phrasing and the overemphasized bravery not left to be read between the lines. In the back of his mind, he had feared the connection to the letter found in Morgrim's unholy sanctum would still lead back to Vale and the past he'd left behind, but he was relieved to find that monsters of such kinds did not connect to him. Relieved and a little disappointed, were he honest with himself. Wishing to avoid whatever tragedy that had fallen to either the owlbears or the harpies, the crew took the one way left and found themselves amid a hoarder's dream, a room filled to the brim with useless junk and old furniture. Searching for anything of value at all, however, is a lesson hard learned when not done carefully. And the clawing attacks of a gargoyle, posing as a mundane statue, came again for Aelin and friends. And adding to the surprise was the sticky nature of a mimic, disguised as a simple crate. After awkwardly defeating these two hiding pranksters in a room with severely limited footing, the crew continued forward, hoping little else remained in their way. Stepping into a literal pigsty, the crew met Bamela, a troll with a sad tale to tell. Raised by a druid and consequently abandoned by their druidic order when her druid died, Bamela sought a home where she would not be hunted down wherever she went. It was here she found some comfort in the care of Lamashtu's monsters. Corvin stepped in with a deceptive strategy, revealing his own third eye, gained from his study of the Arclords of Nex. He gained the trust of the poor and simple Bumilla, convincing her to remain while they dealt with the jackal, Mweeba. As they entered a makeshift chapel to the Mother of Monsters, the crew faced a few different canine-esque creatures, and upon a dais in the chapel, a goblin lay, restlessly squirming and shivering in a sort of fever dream. And a hidden voice extended invitation, and also proudly exclaimed to the crew that the faithful before them screamed as they were gutted, and that the Dawnflower chose not to save them. The voice was, of course, talking about Thida and her followers. And a showdown of monsters began, as a blink dog, goblin dog, and barghest sprang to action, while their Mweeba, the three-eyed Carnugian jackal, tried to catch the crew in its hypnotic stare. Weapons swung and magic was flung and the many different powers of these varied beings pulled the tide of battle this way and that, until the dogs were finally put down and Weeba was drowned within Corvin's conjured aqueous orb. In the quiet aftermath, the evidence of Thyda, Billard, and Vuzi's deaths was clear. The sun wheel was easily recovered, and the white noise of the mysterious goblin's fever dreams slowly fell silent as the hypnotic effects of Muiba's torture subsided. Takira recognized the goblin from when he had worked with Yanyasbara. A back-alley doctor, the leader of the Osprey Club, would have most likely been very happy to see again. And so concludes the story so far. With a less public effort in helping the town of Otari, the expectation of thanks and praise was as little as none, a fact that would undoubtedly make David cringe. But most of the crew were happy with remaining left out of the local gazetteer, and Aelin preferred Vale to have the fame. After all, he'd already had his day in the sun. And the rest of his days would be happily spent at Weinmar's Rod and Boat Club.